All right, welcome to this episode of the Falcon Theater Podcast, everyone. This is an exciting episode because for the first time, Noah and I have a special guest with us. We've always just been the two of us talking, and finally we were able to find somebody who wanted to be on the podcast with us. I'd like to introduce Adam Tex Davis. He is an actual Hollywood writer and producer. He wrote the screenplay for a little movie, a Christmas movie you may have heard of, called Just Friends, starring Ryan Reynolds. And interestingly enough, this movie was filmed in Regina and Moose Jaw. So, you know, we're really excited about him to talk about some of his experiences here in our province. He's also created some educational series like Brain Games and Brain Child. You can see that on Netflix. And he has over a million listeners to his podcasts like Slaycation and The Oscars, What Were They Thinking? He offers some really unique perspectives on the film industry, and we're super excited to have him here today. So welcome, Tex.
Hey, great to be here. When I heard what this was about, I was like, I wanted to be in, and I can't believe I'm the first guest.
Hopefully not the last.
That's fine, too. I don't mind being someone's first and last.
Right off the top, Adam, this is the question that's been just burning at Noah and I. Why us? What brought you to us?
There's an AI program that you can pump in, like, all the data of any podcast. Like, you know, look, I'm promoting. I've got all kinds of stuff to promote. More specifically, my Oscars, What Were They Thinking podcast. And so I'm, like, looking at any kind of film, creativity, writing, anything of that nature. And we put it into the AI, and it spits out all these, different podcasts that have, you know, some connection to that world. And your podcast seemed awesome. And it was in Canada, and, you know, I obviously had the Canadian connection with Just Friends. And, you know, my guy Nick Kastner reached out, and you guys were totally receptive. And when I heard, you know, what you're all about, having a small theater in Canada, I was like, I'm in. I want to talk to these guys.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's so great. I think this has been the only thing that my dad and I have really been talking about since the ball kind of started rolling about a month ago here. So yeah, this has been a big treat for us.
I hope I live up to the internal hype.
Noah and I started this because he lives 3 hours away in Regina, and we don't get to talk. We send memes back and forth all the time, but we don't actually talk very often, but we both love movies, and so we started this podcast as kind of an advertisement for the theater and a way for us to just get together and chat.
That's beautiful. Any opportunity to talk to your kid, I'm all over it. I have a 20-year-old that's a 7.5-8-hour drive from us now. She's in college in Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm in we're in New York. So any opportunity to see or talk is great. I would do a podcast with my daughter in a second. So hats off.
I listened to some of your Slaycation with your wife that you do. I listened, actually, my wife and I were in the car, and we were listening to the one where the wife goes back to the hotel room. My wife's like, because we're heading to Mexico in January, and she's like, maybe you shouldn't be listening to this, because I was starting to get a little fan.
Oh my goodness. Slaycation are they're murders and mysterious deaths that happen on vacation. So the way we look at it is like, if you go on vacation and you murder, you know, one person murders their companion, usually a husband murdering a wife, or a wife murders a husband while they're on vacation and then tries to claim it's an accident and get the insurance money, that's a slaycation. But if you just go on vacation and you get murdered, that is also fair game for us to call it a slaycation. And then if you go on vacation, and this is less, you know, less prominent, but if you go on vacation and decide, oh, I'm going to murder somebody else, crime of convenience or whatever, that is also a slaycation. But if you go on vacation, we say if you go on vacation in the plane and come back under the plane, you've probably gone on a slaycation.
It's incredible to me that there would be that many stories to talk about. Like, just that's a pretty neat, like, a specific topic, and it's like, how, you know, okay, well, you'll have three or four podcasts. No, you guys have quite a lot.
I find sometimes even just getting this all organized is enough work.
Right. We decided before we even start, see if you could find 100 cases. They found like 30 to 40 cases that happened on cruises alone. So they're like, okay, I think we're going to be fine. You know, part of the fun of the show is I don't know the case. So my wife and my business partner, Jerry Kolber, they research the case and then they tell it to me. So then I can make comments and jokes, sometimes inappropriate jokes. But, you know, I'm a sort of proxy for the listener. And I ask the questions that the listener might ask if they were sitting in the room. And it keeps it fun and fresh because I have no idea where this is leading. Unfortunately, a lot of cases. You know, we just did 50. I think we just did our 50th case. And we got plenty in the tank. So come slaycate with us.
That's awesome. I love true crime stuff. So that's something I'll have to check out there.
And the Oscars, what were they thinking? I listened to a couple of those. And that's just so cool that you break down a single year of Oscars like that.
Yeah, the Oscars, what were they thinking, is basically, you know, looking at the Oscars of the past, using the test of time. And, you know, one of the things, you know, a friend of mine and I, we would joke and we'd say, you know, at the end of the year, they give the Oscar for the best movie of the year. And it's actually into the next year. But, you know, it's like we're going to be giving in 2025 the Oscar for the movies of 2024. And we always say, like, that's too soon. That's too soon to know what movies are really going to stay with us for 10, 15 years or so. We should, you know, I jokingly say, yeah, we should be doing the Oscars of 1995 this coming year and really take a look at what stood the test of time. And, you know, it's not even just the winners. It's like just the nominees. And all the performances and the directors. And, you know, when you go back and you look at the Oscars of the past, there's so many weird anomalies or, you know, why did they vote for that? And why wasn't this considered? And why didn't this win? Or why, you know, why was this person left out? And then there's like snubs. And then there's, you know, make good Oscars where they give somebody an Oscar for the fact that they didn't give them an Oscar all time, and then somebody else gets screwed that year. So it's really fun to go back and look at the Oscars of the past. And of course, I'm not doing it alone. I'm doing it with comedy icon and legend Bruce Valanche, who used to be like on Hollywood Squares, and you know, the writer that they would hire. There was a you know, he got hired so much to do you know, punch up work that they made a documentary about him called Get Bruce. And then, of course, he wrote for the Oscars for 25 plus years. So he's got tons of insight and backstories with the celebrities. It's amazing. He's an encyclopedia.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm a huge Oscar buff myself. So that's something I'll really have to check that one out.
Noah and his mother every year would have a huge Oscars party, but it would just be the two of them and a ton of food.
Hey, that's just more for me. Like that's the best part of it, really.
I'm happy to come by. We can watch the Oscars and debate it together. I love Oscars and food. So yeah, Oscars and food are my friends. So
what do you think is the biggest like oh my god, I can't believe that just won Best Picture Oscar, in your opinion?
I mean, you know, there's some of the notable ones. You know, I mean, obviously Shakespeare in Love beating Saving Private Ryan was a big one. You know, Ordinary People's a great movie, but Raging Bull really stands the test of time. But like, for example, we just launched an episode today, which is December 9th. I don't know what day this comes out, your podcast. But the point is, like, we actually look at the 1961 Oscars for the movies of 1960.
Okay, yeah.
Three movies in 1960, three movies came out that are currently on the American Film Institute, the AFI's top 100 American movies of all time. Okay, three came out that same year. Only one of them was actually nominated for an Oscar the year it came out. So I could tell you what it is, or you could listen, but the point is, it's like a weird, like, you know, and then you look at the movies that were nominated, and three of them are very forgettable. So it's like, wait, how did two luminaries get left off the list while three pretty forgettable movies were on the list of nominees? The movie that won, I'll give you that, it was The Apartment You know, Billy Wilder, Jack Lemmon. Great movie. I have no problem with The Apartment winning Best Picture for 1961 Oscars for the 1960 films. I have no problem with The Apartment winning. But the two movies that were left off, it's like real head scratchers. And I'm, you know, I look back and I say, no, we have to make it right. We have to put those movies on the list and remove two movies that don't belong there. And then Bruce will come in and say, well, this is the reason why these movies were not nominated. Here was the political or the socioeconomic or you know, whatever, the cultural at the time, and why these movies might have been overlooked, but how over time they became, you know, favorites and critical darlings, and their stature grew as, you know, with time. So it's a fun back and forth.
What you're saying is they should have listened to your podcast before they decided back then, hey?
If they even had podcasts, it would have been a radio show or something.
So cool to have his insight on these things, right?
Oh, 100%, 100%. And, you know, we fight, which is good. Like, you know, I was hoping, you know, you don't want to do a podcast where everybody just agrees with everything. It's not as, you know, I mean, they teach you the first thing in screenwriting is conflict. So I realized early on, oh, he's not completely on board with my premise of that the Oscars got it wrong. He's more defending the Oscars and why it's okay that they, you know, even if he, you know, personally thinks that, like, Back to the Future is a better movie than Out of Africa and The Color Purple, which I, of course, you know, fully champion. But, you know, he understands what movies are Oscar movies or what he thinks are Oscar movies. And so he will combat with me. And I think that gives the show some real fun.
So just speaking of Out of Africa, I've actually never watched the movie, but I do remember when it came out, I remember my mother going to it and coming home and saying, there's 3 hours of my life I will never get back. She absolutely hated it.
Yeah. Oh, again, that was the thing. Out of Africa and The Color Purple. So this was an episode that we did, actually. It was the 1986 Oscars for the films of 1985. And the two big, you know, nominated movies were Out of Africa with 11 and The Color Purple, also with 11. And it was going to be like, which of these two juggernauts is going to take home the awards? And crazily enough, I think Out of Africa won either 7 or 9 of the 11 Oscars. It won. It like swept out almost everything. Color Purple got 0, nothing. But even more crazy is, you know, Steven Spielberg directed The Color Purple. It was his first really serious movie, and he did a wonderful job with it. But he was snubbed completely and left off the list of director nominees. Like, how do you make a movie that's a Best Picture contender? 3 actors from the movie were nominated. You know, score, script, you know, everything, cinematography, everything is nominated except director. So even Bruce had to admit, well, maybe that was a snub. The directors didn't want to give him that. And then my point is like, okay, so, you know, Out of Africa, like you said, 3 hours you'll never get back. It wins everything. And I'm like, meanwhile, Back to the Future is just sitting there, only the best movie of the year, the highest grossing movie, produced sequels. There's a musical. We still talk about it. It puts so much stuff into the zeitgeist and the lexicon. We're still saying flux capacitor today. I mean, you know, the performances were great. Like, it could have got at least nominated for stuff. So,
yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
Thank you.
On Saturday, on Saturday we had our Santa Claus afternoon show. We showed Polar Express for its 20th anniversary. And there's actually a flux capacitor in that scene in that movie in the train.
Right. Because, well, Zemeckis did both, right? So he.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Zemeckis not nominated. I can find another movie and it's like, you know, all right, this one wasn't nominated or whatever, but we love this movie. We love Die Hard. We love Who Framed Roger Rabbit. We love Shawshank. Like, these are great movies that stood the test of time, and they didn't get the due. So I just love talking about older movies, and especially as we get into the, you know, the later, you know, the earlier years, I should say, where we can really introduce a lot of movies to somebody, you know, their playlist. You know, if you're a movie fan, even in the show notes for the episodes, I list all the movies that we reference in the episode, and there's, you know, 40 of them sometimes. So you can go back and you can, you know, and you can watch stuff and pick up stuff. Even if we just, you know, reference it briefly, like we're talking about Burt Lancaster movies and, oh, by the way, The Swimmer, fantastic. The Killers, fantastic. Kiss the Blood Off My Hands, fantastic. Go see these movies, you know. So yeah, I mean, it's a cinephile's you know, companion, but it also, you know, if you're a casual movie watcher, you'll probably enjoy it as well.
So, Noah and I kind of generated some other questions for you, if you don't mind.
I do not mind.
So one question that came up when we were putting together what we wanted to ask you, when you hand off a script, so you've sold your script, how much creative control do you have after the fact?
Well, let's see. You mean with just friends, for example, or like normally?
We can use that as an example, but yeah, like
sure. So the idea is this: it's like you write something, and you know you're going to have diminished control the further it goes along, right? Like, you know, in TV, the writer is king, so the writer has has a lot of control of their projects in television. But in film, you know that once the studio gets it and buys it, well, now they're a little bit more in control, and they're going to maybe impose notes and things on you. And, you know, look, it's a collaborative thing. And if they want you, you know, if they want you to do it, you can work with them, but you know you're ceding some control. And look, if you get too argumentative and don't want to do the notes that the studio wants, they'll hire somebody else to come in and do it if they think the project is worth it. So you'll be out. My mantra was always be as collaborative as possible, be friends with the studio, be friends with the director, especially when they hire a director, because the director is going to have thoughts and ideas too, and you're going to want to work with them. And look, unless you just don't care and you're just like, I'm going to sell it and walk away, if you want any sort of involvement or, you know, control, befriend the people that are going to come on board and you know, have a higher role. So I work with the studio. You know, we sold it. We did several drafts. We even had a false start with another director, and that director actually wanted to change too much stuff. And the studio was like, no, we like what we bought. You're changing too much. And they got rid of him and they brought in Roger Cumbel. And then Cumbel was like, look, I love the script, but I have some thoughts. And he came to New York and we worked together for like 2 weeks. He loved working with me. And I loved working with him. And he said, look, this is great. I want you on set. I'd love to have you on set if there's anything that comes up. You know, once you start getting the cast involved, now you're making some changes because, oh, well, we've got Ryan Reynolds and we know what he can do and bring to the table. So is there anything we can add to the script or change to make it more in his wheelhouse of his style of comedy? Oh, we've got Anna Faris. We know she's a powerhouse. We can have even more fun with that part and even make it bigger. Add more, like, you know, I added an extra song, I think, because we were like, oh, let's have her in the recording studio. So I wrote that song while I was in Canada, the first one she sings, the Love from Afar. So yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, you're giving up control, but if you work with the people, they might, you know, keep you around for a little while. So, that was my experience with Just Friends. I know that's not other people's experience. Sometimes they sell the script and then they're bye-bye. They might invite them to the set for a day or two, throw them in a cameo. Yeah, you get to be in the background of the court scene, and then they're gone. And other people are, you know, if you're the writer director, obviously, then you have complete control. But yeah, that was my experience though, like working with the people, but knowing I didn't have full control anymore, and you know, I was probably gonna, you know, I had to really argue if I wanted to try to preserve something.
I was just gonna ask, like, if there's any changes that, like, you know, big changes that are going to be made, like, do they go to you first, say, hey, we want to do this, or do they make the change and then kind of let you know, okay, we've made this change, we're going to do it, are you okay with it, or we're just going to do it?
I'll say this, there's a little bit of both. You know, there was a major change that happened in Just Friends to one scene, and it was because of the personal life of one of the actors was a little bit spiraling out of control. And he was supposed to have a bigger part in the ending. And due to some unforeseen things, I'll just say our friend Chris Klein, who played Dusty Dinkelman, was going through a really rough personal patch. And the studio decided it would be in everybody's best interest to get him out of the movie a little sooner. So we had to write a new scene that got him out of the movie. And I guess the director and the actors, they spitballed the scene of how they were going to do it. And then they came to me like during the rehearsal and they said, look, we had to change this. And I said, all right, let me go off and write something. They said, no, we came up with something. And they presented it to me. And I got to be honest, I did not love it. And I said, can I have a chance to work on it? And they were like, the director was like, look, I have to shoot something. The actors came up with it. They're happy with it. I kind of want to go with it. And I was like, let me think about what I can do and maybe make it better. And I left the set and I started noodling it. And when I went to go back on set, the PAs were like, no, the set is locked. You can't go back in. And I was like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. And then they were like, no, they're going to shoot the scene as is. And I was like, all right. So when that scene comes on, I'm like, I don't love it because you got a character who's playing everything masterfully the whole time. And then he does like a slip of the tongue and then suddenly like his whole plan blows up. And that's the Dusty Dinkelman character played by Chris Klein. And then the scene just became this giant Frankenstein scene where it tried to do too much. So honestly, I don't love that one scene in the movie, but otherwise, all the other scenes, any other changes, they came to me, oh, could you come up with a joke for this? Or I'd love to have a little sight gag before that. And it was very collaborative. That scene was near the end of shooting and things were spiraling a little bit. I don't know. Sometimes it's weird. Like, I don't know, you know, if I should say too much. I mean, it's also 20 years ago. Like, who cares? Let's just say this. Chris Klein was engaged to an actress when he came to set in the beginning, and then by the end, that actress was leaving him for another gigantic movie star, and so he was not in a good place.
Understandably so. I think that's pretty fair.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And he's such a great guy. I loved Chris Klein. He could not have been cooler. We watched football every Sunday together. He was a total hangout and just a really good dude. Because of this change, you know, the way the script was, like, you know, Ryan Reynolds' character was supposed to go back to L.A. and Dusty and Amy were supposed to, you know, or Jamie, played by Amy Smart, were supposed to stay together. And then he was supposed to, like, decide to sign Dusty to his record label and, you know, give them money and, you know, make them happy. And then it turns out that they broke up and whatever. So, like, there was a different ending. And then instead, like, it just became this crazy Frankenstein scene of Dusty blowing up his spot and then leaving the movie. And then Ryan also blowing up his spot and him getting punched and then, like, you know, going back to L.A. So it just changed the movie a little bit. You know, I don't love it as a writer, but it's not the worst thing ever. But, yeah, they definitely locked me out because they were like, we have to shoot and we don't have time for your writer shit.
I'll be honest. I really identified with him purely just because he's a paramedic, and I was like, I'm cheering for that guy. I work for the ambulance here in the city, so I was a little bit cheered for him at some points in the movie. But
yep, I mean, yeah, it's funny too because like he's so over the top nice, and then there's that one part where he does reveal that he's like, you know, he's playing a game, which I think is a good reveal, like, but that's to the audience, not to the characters. So it's like, you know, it's like, oh shit. And then, cause you might root for him too much. Like if he's too nice a guy, you know, you're going to root for her to be with him and get Ryan Reynolds out of there. But so we had to make him, you know, deceptively evil so that the main character, you know, that you change your alliance and you're rooting for the main character.
I was fully expecting that that Dusty was going to sign that Ryan Reynolds was going to come in and he was going to realize and he was going to suck because he was a singer and he was a music producer. And I thought that's what was going to happen. Like I was fully expecting that. So
yeah, if you read the script, you would get what you expected. But we had to change it. Chris Klein had to, yeah, we had to get him out of Canada while we still could, I guess. Yeah, he had run afoul of the law back in the States. We snuck him out to be with, it got messy. It got messy. I'm sorry, Chris. I hate to dirty laundry, but like, yeah, he's such a good dude too. And yeah, all of it out of his control. Nothing was his fault.
Another question leading into this whole, like, changing the script and that, how much did Ryan Reynolds improv? Some of the scenes seem very Ryan Reynolds in style, like his style. And did he improv some of that? Or is it just fully scripted?
Somewhere in between. I remember an early conversation that Roger Cumble and I had was, look, Ryan is like Jim Carrey-esque in his ability to come up with cool stuff, both physically and verbally. And so what we're going to do is we're always going to do a Ryan take. You know, like, we're going to let him, you know, we'll do like two or three or four takes of the script and the way, you know, the way it's sort of mapped out. And then we're going to let him do a take or two. And if there's anything he wants to add or do differently, or, you know, so we you know, into the schedule, there was like, you know, time for Ryan takes to do stuff. And sometimes he would be like, no, I don't really have anything. I think we got it, you know, whatever. And other times he's like, all right, let me try something. And sometimes it was just like doing the same thing, but a little more over the top. Like that scene where he's sitting in the car and after the day date. And the body shake, and then he's sitting in the car, and he's like, he starts doing like finger puppets or whatever, mapping out the horror of the date that just went disastrously wrong, and he just went really over the top with it. She showed up in the window, she forgot her mittens and catches him, doing this whole pantomime with his fingers, and like that was just built up from like, earlier takes, and then it's just like, go wild. And then he did one that was so funny, like she cracked up, so we couldn't even use that take because she was laughing. Although maybe that's kind of the one we used, like, her laugh is so genuine, like maybe, I'm not sure if that's the one that got used or not, but giving him the space and the freedom to do over the top stuff. I can't say all of that made it into the movie. Sometimes it might be too much, but yeah, we definitely played into what he can do, and he's great. I mean, even in the beginning when he's in the balcony at the party, and they're reading the yearbook and what he wrote, and he's like, just like, that's not me. And like, I was almost, we were almost in tears. Like, it's like, oh my God, it's so sad. And he's a good actor.
That's really cool. I've always been curious, like, how much freedom actors are given. And I'm sure it's probably dependent on the director that's running the movie, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the good, confident directors are willing to, obviously, look, there's a time factor too. You have to plow through how much of the script, but if you have the chance, the good directors will allow their actors the freedom to explore, to try new things, to go, go off script. One thing that Roger did that I really loved was finding ways to, even within the script, to get different performances by tweaking the way in which the actors would deliver. Like, for example, like, all right, in this scene, he loves you and you are confused, say. Then it's like, all right, now I want to play it again. He loves you, but you hate him. Then it's like, okay, now play it again. I want both of you, you both hate each. Okay, now I want you to play it again. And he just keep tweaking their motivation or tweak their, the way in which they're going to play the scene, just to get different variances. And sometimes, like, it's like, oh, that scene came to life with that weird connection, so even within the scene, and all the words are the same, you can change the motivation of the character, and suddenly it gives you a whole different performance to work with.
And I guess that's what acting's all about, is the ability to change your motivation at a whim like that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Say it like this, now say it like that. And then, like, you have somebody like Anna Faris who can just, she would have like a line, like when she's in the bar and she's losing patience, people were just like, whether it was me or Roger, would just like shout out another line for her to say, and she would just say it back in character hilariously, and that those became things in the movie. Like, you know, he's like, "I'm busy," and then, you know, it's like, "Say I'm busy," and it's like, stupid dick," and like, she's so good at like just making, you know, any line come to life. You could throw her any line, and she would, you know, she'd make a meal out of it.
The more I watch movies, the more I've come to realize that the actors are the face of the movie, but the director is really the one who truly understands the vision and the movie in its entirety. And I've often wondered, like, when they do their press gambits to promote a movie, they always send out the actors to all the talk shows and that. Why don't they send the director? The director is the one who actually understands it. It's because the director doesn't want to do that.
It's probably also because the people, like, you know, some directors are stars, you know, Martin Scorsese is always going to get booked on talk shows, Steven Spielberg and stuff, but, you know, usually they're like, you know, they're, you know, not the charismatic people, you know, they want the actors out there, you know, who do you want on the show? The guy, like, you know, saying cut, or The Rock, you want The Rock, you know, it's like, I think, you know, I mean, look, you know, again, some people appreciate the directors, but a lot of directors are, you know, they're either weird or they're introverted. You know, they're not the face of the movie. You got the Tarantino who can, you know, go out and do it and talk and, you know, is great, but not a lot of directors are like that. A lot of directors are more quiet and reserved, you know, off the set. And, you know, also, what do the fans want to see? The fans want to see the famous people, the stars, the good-looking people, and the people in the movie. So, and it's funny, you know, it's funny you said, like, you know, the director, you know, knows the vision. Like, the director will come up with a vision, you know. That's the fun part between the writer and the director. The writer might have a whole different vision, and then the director is, like, going off and doing, come up with something else, and it's like, you know, again, you know, the writer, you're just like, all right, well, I sold my script and I'll go home, you know, check my bank account. But, you know, I did give up control. You know, the director has a whole vision, you know, that's different than mine. You know, what can you do? You want to work in this business or not? You know, nobody's forcing you to do it. You know, if you don't like it, then you could sell shoes. I don't know.
Okay, so I guess the one question that I had is, why was Saskatchewan chosen for the setting in New Jersey? Like, I'm sure there's the, you know, the people that go out that find all the locations and everything, but was it just because snow is widely available here, or did they not know that it was going to be minus 30, you know?
You know, it was a combination of things. Well, first of all, you know, New Line Cinema was the studio, but they did get bring in money and a Canadian producer, actually a guy, he died not that long ago, his name was Bill Vince or William Vince, and he was a Canadian producer. He had done movies like Air Bud and I'm trying to remember some of the other movies. I just remember Air Bud especially because sometimes he would come, and he's a big guy. He was like a hockey player. So he'd come in very strong, like, I think, and we would just jokingly like, what, the dog kicks a field goal? The dog scores a touchdown? What do you got? And then like, he would like laugh or whatever. But yeah, we had Canadian producers. So they were familiar with Canadian resources, and they were like, look, there's these beautiful new studios, I think there was only one at the time, but it was a beautiful studio in Regina where you can shoot all these interiors and stuff, and it's a fraction of the cost, and it's a great studio, it's a great way to save money, but also, yeah, it's the movie takes place over Christmas, there's tons of snow, we don't have to, you know, have fake snow imported in and all that. It's cold as hell. You'll be able to see people's breath when they're talking. So that'll add to the misery of him stuck there. The ice skating scene, like, oh, you don't have to freeze a lake or do anything. Nope. There's plenty of frozen places to film your, you know, we had a hockey rink that we, you know, shot in Moose Jaw. Then we had that frozen lake where we shot the hockey scene with the kids. I can't remember exactly where that was. Might probably around the Moose Jaw area, But like, yeah, all that stuff existed. So it was like, why not? And yeah, you got tax breaks galore. And I got to be honest, like the Canadian crew, like a lot of locals and people either from Vancouver or Calgary or Edmonton or whatever, they came in. They were great. They worked their asses off. I was like, man, they put some of our crews to shame, like that I've seen, you know, and I jokingly said like, that we had a hockey scene and these guys were shooting like we were making a hockey movie. So it was kind of hilarious. It's like, okay, I think we got it. No, we could do it better. And it's like, you know, relax. We've got enough. In fact, you know, Ryan doesn't play hockey. So, you know, we shot his close-ups and stuff. And then we had like, you know, a stand-in to, you know, to skate and to be him. And we had two guys come in to do it. And they were so good that we had to go with our third choice guy because we're like, if these guys are so good at hockey, people will think like, why didn't he just become a professional hockey player? So we had to like get the third best guy became his stand-in for the hockey scene. So it's like, okay, he's a good, you know, a good men's league player, but he's not like a professional hockey player. So, yeah, that, you know, but between the studio and the snow and all that stuff, yeah, it was a perfect place to shoot it. And it looked like Jersey. Like people don't say, oh, it doesn't look like Jersey. It totally passes for Jersey.
It's funny because there's you know, especially where the houses are, like for work, especially I drive down that road multiple times a day and see those houses. Even the exterior shot that you guys use for the hospital is a rehabilitation center. And we actually, one of our satellite stations for work is in that building. So I'm in that building multiple times a week and everything. Does not look as good on the inside as it did in the movie. It's a little, I don't like being inside there, but no, it was really interesting. Like, you know, for me watching it, I'm like, oh, this isn't New Jersey. This is Regina. I know exactly what street that is. I think I've even been to that house.
That's funny. Yeah. I mean, yeah, one of the houses, what was it? The exterior of, I guess it was the exterior and the interior of her house, of Amy Smart's character, of Jamie. Her house was like the Canadian like health minister or something. So it was this nice big house. Yeah, I got in trouble because, it was so cold. It was so freezing that like when we were shooting like night exteriors, we would smoke cigars just to keep warm, you know, just like having a nice fire stick. And I remember one night I didn't finish my cigar and it, you know, it felt like a waste to just throw it out. It was a nice, you know, a Cuban cigar, you know, apparently you can get Cuban cigars in Canada, like the real thing. You know, I didn't want to just throw it out. So I put it in a napkin or something and I left it in the house next to like the monitors and stuff, knowing that I would come in the next day. And I just thought it was just the crew there. You know, we had the house. And then I show up on set and everybody's lined up like an inquisition is happening. And it's like, what's going on? And they're like, who is the idiot that left a cigar in the Canadian health, you know, the health minister of Saskatchewan's like house? The whole program is anti-smoking. Which one of you morons left a cigar in the house? And they just assumed it had to be some grip or PA or something. And I was like, oh, that was me. Yeah, the writer. And, you know, they couldn't be too mad. You know, they couldn't be too mad at the above the line guy. But at the same time, I was like, whatever. And I was like, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that was their anti-smoking platform. I didn't even realize somebody would come in the house and see it. I was like, and it was out. It wasn't like, you know, lit, you know, it was pretty funny.
It wasn't putting smoke out into the room.
No. And it wasn't like a fire hazard or anything. It was, an extinguished cigar. But I left it on the kitchen counter on a napkin, and I guess that was a no-no.
So sadly, our provincial government has cut funding to like movie production and stuff like that. So nowadays, chances are a movie like yours probably wouldn't have gotten made in Saskatchewan because there isn't tax breaks for those sort of things anymore. There's hardly any movie productions being done in our province because of the provincial government cutting the breaks for those.
I think it's unless you really want to make a movie here, it's really the only reason to do it anymore now.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, look, I know the tax breaks were definitely part of it, and the beautiful studio was part of it, though, as well. I mean, and then, you know, obviously the snow. So maybe it would still be considered for Just Friends, but I guess for other films, if you're looking for tax breaks, and I know a lot of states here in the U.S. are trying to really, you know, compete. You know, Atlanta, Georgia, you know, is got a whole tax thing. So a lot of movies are being shot there, and then Tennessee and Kentucky and stuff like that are really trying to lure production with the tax breaks and stuff. But that's a shame.
The soundstage you were talking about, I think a lot of Corner Gas was done on that soundstage. That was a big part of Corner Gas, if I remember correctly.
And we had one of the stars of Corner Gas on our show, in our movie, Fred Iwanek.
Yeah. Did one thing, I don't know if you know this, but Brent Butt, who created Corner Gas, he actually is from Tisdale. He grew up a couple of blocks away from me. Actually got into a playground scrap with Brent Butt one time. He was a couple years older than me, so he just kind of held me and tossed me around and laughed, but it's my story, funny story about Brent.
I love how Canadians call fights scraps. I love that. I mean, I'm a hockey player, so I'm like, yeah, it's like, oh man, they had a nice scrap in the third period, or you know, whatever. Like, I love that.
Funny that you're a hockey player from the U.S., but Ryan Reynolds is not a hockey player from Canada.
I was shocked. I mean, again, I love hockey. So here's a fun story. You know, that scene, I'll tell you what it was actually based on. Now, I was in the friend zone in college. That was like a horrible friend zone situation. For 2 years, I was with this, you know, I was friends with this girl. We were like best friends. We slept in the same bed. We did everything together, except we weren't dating, because she had a boyfriend who was like much older. And I thought for sure she would realize, this guy's a loser. Like, why is this guy in his like mid 30s dating a girl who's still in college, a 21-year-old? And she's going to realize that she's going to dump him. And of course she's going to turn to me, except it never happened. And I turned down other opportunities, and I was just mired in this friend zone, thinking I was the vice president, and eventually the president would get impeached or assassinated and I would take office, and it never happened. But also in high school, I had little dabblings in the friend zone, and there was this one girl who was a really, really pretty girl. I was friendly with her, and we were playing floor hockey in gym class, and I was like a hockey player, so most of the guys, you know, in my school didn't play hockey, so I could tool around them pretty easily, and I'm like, I'm going to impress the shit out of her with my floor hockey, and then she's going to want to go on a date with me, and that was my stupid idea. So I score a goal very easily, and the teacher, gym teacher, is like, Davis, go, you're going to be in the goalie. You're going to be the goalie. I don't want you just tooling around everybody. So I go in goal, and now I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it as the goalie. So I make a save, and then I tool around everybody in the court, and I score a goal as the goalie. And now the teacher's like, Davis, you're the goalie. You stay in the goal. You don't come out. And I was like, okay. So now my thought is, I'm going to score a goal as the goalie from the goal, and I'm going to just shoot it across the entire gym and score. And this is going to really impress her. So I make a save, I line it up, and I whack it before I do, actually, I point at her, like, hey, check it out. And I whack it as hard as I can. And the goalie stick is not meant for shooting, of course. And the puck went flying sideways and hit her right in the head. And she was in the bleachers, and she fell out of the bleachers, and she banged her head, and she had the ambulance had to come, and they had to put her in like on the gurney, and then, you know, put a thing around her neck, and they wheeled her off. And the last thing, she was just like, you asshole, she said, because I fucking pointed at her, and then I took the shot, and I don't know what happened. So we never spoke again. So I had that in my back pocket, that story. And in an early draft, he actually, Ryan Reynolds' character, Chris, shoots the puck and hits the girl. And then the studio is like, we can't have, you know, there was early, you know, talk about like who would be in the movie. There was a point where they thought Adam Sandler and Julia Roberts could be the two. And I remember them saying, like, Adam Sandler can't shoot a hockey puck and give Julia Roberts a black eye or knock out a tooth. Like, you can't do that. So it's like, all right, what if he hurts himself? So then that's how that story turned into what's in the movie, where he winds up shooting the puck, it hits the crossbar, bounces kind of incredibly back and hits him in the mouth or whatever. But that all stemmed from this early story of my gym class and me trying to impress a girl with hockey. But I do play hockey and Canadian Ryan Reynolds. So yeah, I wrote the hockey into the movie, and then, you know, you got Ryan Reynolds is like a physical specimen. You'd think like, oh, this guy must be super athletic, and as a Canadian, he has to play hockey. No hockey at all.
That's hilarious. I guess, going off for your past and like growing up and everything, what would you say is like either your favorite movie? I mean, I know that's a very broad question, or the movie or movies that got you into, hey, I want to do this. I want to make movies. I want to write movies. I want to get into this business. What was kind of what led you into wanting to do that?
Well, the one thing that I did that I knew made me a little different than like other kids, like I saw Star Wars, the original Star Wars, when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And, you know, what kid didn't love Star Wars back then? But one thing I did that was a little different was I grabbed a notebook and I wrote out the entire movie to the best of my memory. And I just wrote it as a story. And I don't know why, it was very important for me to do that in my own words, to rewrite the movie Star Wars. And, you know, what was the first script I ever wrote? I guess it was my take on Star Wars with, from my memory. And so that was a huge movie for me. And then the movie that probably made me want to make movies was Jaws, because I loved sharks and I loved horror movies. But then it's like I'm watching this movie and I had seen a lot of dumb horror movies and monster and creature. But it's like I'm like, wait, this is different. This is great. This is a phenomenal movie. Beyond, like, I'm enjoying the non-shark scenes. Why is that? You know, like, you know, as a kid, you're supposed to only love watching people get eaten. I'm enjoying everything and the suspense and everything. So Jaws and Star Wars, Raising Arizona was a huge movie for me before I went into film school. I loved Taxi Driver was another huge one for me. Which is interesting because none of these are really comedies, but I guess Raising Arizona is a comedy, but yeah. And then, you know, Airplane and early Chevy Chase movies I thought were really funny. But for the most part, yeah, I'd say Jaws and Star Wars, Indiana Jones, great, Close Encounters. Those were the movies that got me into wanting to make movies. And then I discovered, obviously, The Godfather and stuff like that. A lot of movies from the 70s became very instrumental to me. Dog Day Afternoon, Sidney Lumet is one of my favorite directors of all time. Those were kind of the movies.
That's so cool. Like, I was 8 when Star Wars came out. And, of course, back then, the only way you could watch Star Wars was at the movie theater. And so at our movie theater, I went to it 8 times. They had it 2 weekends for 4 days each week, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I went every night for 2 weekends in a row.
Oh, yeah. I saw it about 5 times. My dad, luckily, was into it as I was. And my dad actually called at Empire Strikes Back, he called the father thing. He figured it out. He said it before, like he was like, I bet it's his father. And then when it came out, you know, I was equally surprised by the movie, you know, like Luke, you know, I am your father. He had said it. And so I was doubly surprised. I was surprised by the movie doing it like everybody else. And I was also like, Dad, how did you know? Did you talk to George Lucas? Like, you know, but, he was like a big kid too. So he took me about 5 times to see Star Wars. So wait, are you born 71?
I was born in 69.
Okay. Wait, didn't you come out in 77?
Yeah, so I was like 8 years old.
I was younger, I guess. I was like Seven.
And like for me, because I mean, I grew up with it just kind of being, you know, it was just normal to have it on all the time. And I mean, how many VHS tapes of Star Wars I'm literally looking right. If I look in front of me right now, they're not the original ones I had, but I have my VHS copies in my TV cabinet right in front of me right now. You know, that was the way I grew up watching it. It was over and over, just watching it again and again. I could probably quote the entire first movie just off memory.
What do you guys think of the later ones? You know, these more recent ones.
You know, honestly, I'm in the minority. I loved The Last Jedi. I thought The Last Jedi was such a unique take on it was something different, something new. There's a couple parts that, you know, kind of break up the flow and aren't the best, but out of the newest trilogy, The Last Jedi is my favorite. I think Rogue One is my favorite out of all the new movies that they've made. But out of like the 7, 8, 9, I'd say 8 is probably my favorite of what they've done.
Okay. Yeah. Rogue One, I thought, was really a good movie. I really liked it. And then that ending was phenomenal. Like, that wrapped around to New Hope was great. Yeah, it's funny. I don't like any of the newer ones except Rogue One. I didn't hate the prequels as much as other people did, but I, you know, it was definitely like a little down after the first two, but the third one of the prequels was so good that I thought it was like almost like a setup, like I'm gonna lull you into hating these other two and then hit you with such a great movie that that it'll make it all worth it. And like just that switch where it's like, oh my God, the Empire, you know, went from being the good guys to the bad guys, and like, you know, it was pretty amazing. But
if only they could have done that with the sequel movies.
Yeah, no, I know
the sequels were not well thought out, and I just the jumping around, they're just poorly written from a storyline perspective, in my opinion. And I didn't really like any of the three.
They didn't need to be made other than money and other than,
no,
you know. So it's like that when that's the motivation, it's always, you know, it wasn't part of the visionary thing anymore.
They were trying to get a new generation involved in the story, and they weren't writing it for us old guys.
No, that is true, because I know younger people do like them, you know, friends that have younger kids and stuff, they're like, oh, my kids love it. So it's like, okay. So then it was successful. We've aged out.
Changing the subject here a little bit, Adam. My youngest son, Eric, he's 25, but he likes to write. And so I asked him, I said, okay, so I'm going to be talking to a screenwriter today. What's one question you would like me to ask him for you? So this is the question from my son, Eric. What is the biggest mistake that someone who's starting out writing can make?
Well, let's see. Mistake is, I guess there's a couple of things. One is, don't think that what the first thing you're going to write is going to be great. You know, you get better at it by doing it. So just be prepared to write and then to rewrite and to rewrite. One mistake that I definitely would encourage not to, some people will write a script and they might even do a couple of rewrites on it, and they might send it out and get like maybe not a great response on it, which is typical of a first script. And then they'll go back and they'll just keep working on that same script over and over for years and years. And it's like, one of the things I had to do was like, okay, you know what? I've taken this as far as it can go. It's not going anywhere. I'm going to put it aside and I'm going to write something else. And if that doesn't work, I'm going to put that aside and I'm going to write something else. So with my career, for example, you know, between, you know, I went to film school, I went to NYU, and I made a film while I was there. And that film actually, you know, did the festival circuit and somebody liked it and they brought it out to LA to start showing people. And that's how I got a manager to call me. Now, in the meantime, between, you know, making that film and graduating school, again, I'm working in a factory, I'm working in a bagel store, but I'm writing. Every night I'm writing. I finished a script and then I put it aside and I wrote another one. And I had another idea and I wrote another one. And I wound up writing 4 feature-length screenplays. So when my movie went out to LA and a manager called me and they said, hey, I loved your movie. I can't do anything with that. What else do you have? So I said, well, I've written four scripts. And he said, send me your best two. So I sent the two that I thought were the best. And he said, okay, look, I don't know. These are kind of indie. I don't think like the studios will buy it. I don't know if it'll get, but it'll be a great sample because it's got a great voice and there's some great comedy in there. There's some fun characters. So a big mistake is not writing. So always be writing. And another, they went around and you know, people like them. What else do you have? What else do you have? So I had to get back on the horse and write another script. And that one we went out with thinking it could sell, and it didn't sell. And I was bummed that this script that I thought for sure was going to sell because I had learned from the other ones and I was working with my manager and stuff. No, didn't sell. So then I was bummed, and I thought, oh, what's another time I've been bummed like this? Oh, I know, when I was in the friend zone for 2 years with that girl in college. You know what? I'll write about that experience. And then I wrote Just Friends. And then I get a call like, oh, somebody wants to buy that first script, and New Line wants to buy Just Friends, and also MTV wants to hire you to do a made-for-cable movie. And that all happened in the span of a month and a half or something. But again, if I had not been writing on my own, that would have been a big mistake. If I, you know, was so bummed out by not selling my first script and write another thing for a while, that would have been a mistake. So if you're going to be a writer, then write. You know, that's the biggest thing. Write and you know, rewrite if you feel like, you know, oh, I got to make some changes or something. Or if you read it and you're like, oh, this stinks. That happens to me all the time, by the way. I write something and I read it and I'm like, oh, this is terrible. And then I'm like, oh, wait, nobody saw it yet. I can fix it. And I'm a good enough writer to know when what I've written sucks. So I go back and I rewrite it. But again, you gotta, you know, if you're trying to get into the business or whatever, you gotta write multiple things. Don't put all your eggs in one basket and then just work on that. I've got so many friends that have done that. They spent 10 years honing and rehoning the same thing. And it's like, dude, it's not the words on page 18. It's they don't like the idea. Write something else. If you're a real writer, you'll write something else. You're going to write multiple things. So I guess hopefully that helps.
Yeah, that's great. That actually kind of brings up my next question. Do you have scripts out there that you've sold that are just sort of sitting in studio hell? You know, you would love for them to get made, but...
Not so much like sold and sitting in studio hell. I mean, I have one that was sold and nothing happened to it. Oh, so yeah, I've got things in all different stages. Very first script I sold, I actually sold it to Harvey Weinstein at Miramax. This was a long time ago, before any of the allegations and stuff. But you know what? He was still disgusting then. I have no problem saying that. But the point is, he bought my first script. And yeah, that's sitting on a shelf. And I've even had offers. Universal had reached out one time. They read it and they were like, hey, can we get that script out of Miramax? And Miramax wanted so much money that Universal said no. Then these indie producers, they read it and they wanted to do something with it, and they couldn't afford to get it out of Miramax. So that's sitting on a shelf there. I don't know why they just keep it there. I have scripts that I was paid to write that are sitting on a shelf. I have one or two things that I have written that I had like producers and one that had a director attached. Nothing's happened yet. They're trying to get some money, I guess, and, you know, trying to attach an actor. So that's been years process. There's things in all different stages. But again, you know what you do? You just keep writing. I mean, I've got lots to keep me busy now. I'm doing all these podcasts and stuff, but I'm also writing in my spare time. And I just finished a horror movie. We went out to a couple of places. It didn't work for one or two places, so we're going to try to find some other places to go to. Love to attach maybe a producer to that. And meanwhile, I've got four more ideas for things. So I'm just trying to, who's going to win the battle royale of the idea that's going to be the next one to write. Just always keep doing it. You know, and if you don't love doing it, then it's probably not for you. My agent used to say as a joke, he'd be like, you're one of the few writers I have that actually loves to write. And I didn't understand what that meant. Like but then I guess there's people that, you know, they have the talent to do it, but they don't love doing it. So they do it when they can sporadically and procrastinate and whatever. But yeah, if he loves doing it, just do it as much as you can. You get better the more you do it.
Maybe you need to go talk to George R. R. Martin, because I just read the other day that he's saying now he probably won't finish Game of Thrones.
That guy has given plenty. But yeah, I mean, yeah, sometimes it's like, look, he might be in a tough spot where, you know, it's like, I'm at least fortunate. All my scripts are different. Like, this guy is just stuck in this slog of the same thing. And you know, trying to, you know, finish this behemoth might be tough, you know, and you get older and you know, you become less, you know, when you're a little less spry and it's just like, oh my God, it's so tedious. To be honest, I mean, I don't love writing starting from a blank page as much as I like rewriting. So nowadays, and look, maybe your son could be part of this. I like to find young, hungry writers who will write something, you know, that's good, that's a good idea. And maybe we even work on an outline together so I know where the story is going. And then they write the first draft, and then I rewrite the hell out of the second draft. And then a lot of times it's easier to work with, you know, stuff on the page already as opposed to just a blank page. You know, I find myself doing a lot more of rewriting other stuff than starting from my, you know, starting from scratch on my own. But I still do it.
That's really cool. I'll definitely talk to him about it. That's really neat. It just makes me think also what we were just saying about you know, the slog of writing. I remember my buddy and I were big Wheel of Time readers, you know, and it was taking Robert Jordan forever to put out his next book all the time. And we jokingly said, boy, he's not going to finish this series before he dies. And well, he got sick and passed away. And thankfully he got Brandon Sanderson to finish the series. And Brandon did a great job of the voice of Robert Jordan. He was able to mimic that voice of writing.
That is cool. I was going to say the other mistake that people make, I remember it was funny when my manager, you know, I signed with my manager, and then we were trying to figure out what to write as the first script that we're going to really try to go out with. And he said, do me a favor, like, no mafia, no the president, no cops, like just picking some of these things that people love to write about. But it's like, I'm not in the mafia. I'm not a police officer. The president, there was so many, like, the president's daughter and the president's this is kidnapped and blah, blah, blah. And the president's being kidnapped. And blah. He's like, stay away from, can you write something just based on real, like, what you know, what you've experienced, like, you know, find stories that are close to you. And, so yeah, that's something I always also like to pay forward is like, yeah, you know, a lot of times people don't understand what is unique about their own life or their own situations or things that have happened. And, you know, that's a great place to start because you can mine a lot of that for gold. Like I said, Just Friends was based on, you know, me being in the friend zone. Yeah, the movie, you know, wasn't like the movie. I didn't, you know, I wasn't fat one day and then suddenly looked like Ryan Reynolds and came back to my hometown. Like, all that's, you know, manufactured for the movie. But, you know, the idea of the friend zone and the idea of, you know, being the just friends guy and all that and trying to get out of that, you know, that was real. So that came from a real place. And then even the script I sold to Harvey Weinstein was based on, I wound up on spring break with my parents 1 year. I was just out of college and, my parents had a timeshare in Mexico. So they invited me to come and it was going to be me and my girlfriend and my brother and his girlfriend and everybody else couldn't get off work except I wasn't even working. I don't think at the time. And my parents were like, you're going to come with us to, you know, we have a timeshare in Cancun. And I was like, ah, fuck it. I'm just out of school. Why not? And I go to Mexico with my parents and we get out of the airport and it's like, welcome spring breakers. And I'm like, oh no, it's spring break. I didn't even realize. And now we're in a hotel and there's kids partying everywhere. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. But I'm like, screw it. I got a notebook and I just tried to manufacture as much fun as I could. I'm going to get my mom in a foam party in Senior Frogs and my dad's in the hot tub smoking weed with the frat boys. And like any stupid thing that could happen, I just was writing down all the scenarios and all the fun that was happening. And I turned that into a movie and that became this like teen sex comedy. Unfortunately, it's sitting on a shelf. But the point is it did start with a germ of a real idea or germ of a thing that actually happened. So I would encourage to mine your own, you know, mine your own life, mine things that that actually happened.
Write what you know.
Write what you know. Exactly.
So next, I next question I had for you. When Nick reached out to me, he said that you collaborated with Leonardo DiCaprio on something, but I was curious about what that was like. What's it like collaborating with Leonardo?
So talk about on a shelf. Except this case, it's an actual movie. So I had written Just Friends. I had written a couple other things. I had gotten hired to do some rewrites and some stuff like that. And it was all very PG rated stuff. And I felt like, at my core, I like R rated stuff and I wanted to be a little more edgy. I had just seen Fight Club, I think, and I loved it so much. And I was like, oh my God, I gotta write something cool and dark and edgy. So I wrote this movie called The Gardener of Eden. And it's like a vigilante comedy, dark, but like weird, but like, you know, trying to be very real. And I brought, you know, stuff, you know, I worked in a bagel store. So it starts with the character working in the bagel store. And then he gets fired. He gets kicked out of his house. He's been, you know, kicked out of college. He's got nothing going on in his life. And he decides, fuck it, I'm going to beat up the next person I see. And he beats up this guy in the street. And the cops come and he thinks he's going to go to jail. But it turns out the guy he beat up was wanted for sexual assault in the neighborhood. There was posters up. So he's suddenly a hero. And suddenly everybody, you know, is worshiping him. And he decides that's his calling. I'm going to be a vigilante. And he's not good at it and stuff. So, but it's like very, you know, dark and real. And I wrote this movie, just poured out of me. And I sent it to my agent. And he was like, look, I don't know if studios are going to get it. Producers might get it. He goes, but I bet especially actors who have studios, movies, they might love this. So he said, I got a guy I'm going to send it to. And he sent it to Appian Way, which was Leonardo's, company. And I get a call back. It's like, oh, he's reading the script. He loves it. He wants to meet you. So I had to go to this meeting with Leo, and it was funny because I showed up. It was in a hotel in New York during the summer, so I was wearing shorts. And I go into this cafe where, you know, within the hotel there's like a cafe bar thing, and it was a very, you know, fancy hotel. And they wouldn't let me in. They're like, "Sorry, sir, shorts are not allowed." And I was just like, "Dude, you see that A-list actor sitting over there, like who wants to take my career to the next level? Please do not let like 1 foot of fabric stand between me and my career." I was like, "All right, fine, run. And I like ran in and sat down next to him. And like he was there, his father was there, his manager was there. During the meeting, he gets a call from Scorsese about like Gangs of New York, and he has to take like a hush call. And that's when you realize like we're not really friends. Like we're talking very friendly about the script, and he loves it, and he's talking, you know, put his hand on my knee at one point and like looked me right in the eye and told me the two things that he loved in the script. His dad is like quoting pages, and I'm like, this is so surreal. And then he gets this call from Scorsese, and I was like, oh, Gangs of New York, yeah, I'm excited about that. How's that going? And he's like, and he just clams up, nobody says a word, and then he's like, so then I was just like, anyway, on page 18. Yeah, page 18. Okay, and then we get back into the conversation. I was just like, holy shit, I almost blew it right there. And then it was great, though. You know, his company made the movie. There was like, you know, little starts and stops. We had a lead actor who was perfect for the part because he was supposed to be a big, heavyset dude. Who then, like, over the course of his vigilanteism, he starts getting in shape and stuff. But in the beginning, he's this big, fat, schlubby dude who's not getting girls and not, you know, nobody pays attention to him. And he had a friend, Ethan Suplee, who's the actor who's in the TV show My Name is Earl and was in Mallrats. He's, like, the big, heavy guy looking at the thing to try to find the image in the picture. He's been in a bunch of things. American History X. He was one of the skinheads. So he was the huge guy. Anyway, he's great. He's great. And I was so excited to have him as the lead actor. But then he got cast in My Name is Earl before we started shooting. So then we had to find a new actor. And so I had to rewrite the script for a different actor who I wasn't sure was right for the part because he wasn't a big heavyset guy. He was a skinny guy. But they're trying to tell me, no, it's okay. It's gonna work better this way. And I'm like, I don't know, man. Anyway, the point is some stops and starts and stuff, but we got the movie made. And I will say this, Leo did not, you know, he was instrumental in putting it all together. And every now and then I would get a note and it would just be a really good, smart note. Like, and it wouldn't even be like telling me. It would just be like, have you considered blah, blah, blah? And I was just like, oh, that's good. And like, it's so refreshing to get like notes that like, you know, are going to make the movie better. So, yeah, the notes were few and far between, but they were always great. And yeah, he showed up on set a bunch of times. I was mostly working with the director. Again, you know, I ingratiated myself with the director, who was Kevin Connolly, who played E on Entourage. And we had a cool cast. Giovanni Ribisi's in it. Erica Christensen's in it. David Patrick Kelly, the guy from the Warriors. Warriors, come out and play. Like, he was in it.
That's awesome. That.
Yeah. And we had great indie cast. And the movies, you know, I mean, look, we didn't have a lot of money, but we made the money work for what we had. And yeah, played at the Tribeca Film Festival, and they got offers. And then the guy who put up the money didn't want to sell it. Was willing to take the loss, maybe because he had to offset some other stuff. I don't know. And that movie is like sitting on a shelf. And it's been since, 2005, 2006. Because it, you know.
How do we get to see this movie?
You know, it pops up here and there. I know it played overseas and it got like pirated. So friends of mine were like going on pirate sites and seeing it. I know it was on Amazon Prime for like a month or something. And somebody said, I think your movie's on Amazon Prime. So I quickly told everybody, check it out while it's still there. You know, it pops up every now and then. They took the off for some reason. And now it's just called Gardener of Eden. I got rewritten on the title, but anyway, the movie's, you know, it's this dark, weird little comedy, comedy drama, and yeah, you might be able to find it. You know, I don't know what your aversion to Russian pirate sites are for movies, but probably not as a theater owner. It's hard to find, and it's kind of a shame. It was a good piece of work. It's not perfect, but it's not bad at all. That's like, one of those like things. It was like a super high point working with Leo and going through that experience, and then a low point of like, oh, nobody can see it. Weird.
There's so many steps to making, you know, from the writing room all the way to it being, you know, distributed. And like, you know, we've seen like, what was it? There was that Acme movie that came out that was fully made and everything. And then the studio was like, nope, we don't want to put it out. Cause it's going to cost us more money to just tax write it off, you know, which is unfortunate. Cause all the work and the art behind something like that, just never getting to see the light of day, is just really, you know, something like that's really sad, but I guess that's business at the end of the day, you know?
It really is. I mean, it's one of those things where, yeah, it would almost be better if it didn't exist, but the fact that it exists and people can't see it, is, you know, and then you figure like in today's age, like just release it to like a Netflix or a streamer or something, let it go on Tubi, you know, I don't know, just play it somewhere.
Yeah. There's so many options out there nowadays. It's like, just put it on something, right?
Matinee show at the Falcon, you know, I don't know.
Speaking of the Falcon, I always like to, in our podcast, kind of go over what's coming up at the Falcon Theater so that people who are listening know what's coming. First of all, I just want to say we've done a huge renovation to the outside thanks to a donation of a local group that financially supported us. But we finally got the signage up on the front, and it's really cool because they've gone back to... We looked at pictures of the original, like in 1945 when the theater was built, and the signage is very similar to that original look. So that's kind of cool. We have coming up here next weekend the best Christmas pageant ever. And then after that, for 2 weeks, is the first time since I've been running the theater, I've been running just over 2 years, we're going to show Wicked for 2 weeks in a row. And usually we don't try to show a movie for 2 weeks, but this one I've had so many people asking about it. So the weekend before Christmas and then the weekend after Christmas, we're going to show Wicked and see how that goes.
Here you have a great movie on the 17th coming out.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. So on December 17th, we have the movie Just Friends playing at the Falcon Theater, 8 p.m. on Tuesday night. And I'm so excited about it. Thank you again for recording that little pre-movie piece that I'm going to show everybody. I hope we get a really, really good turnout for it, because I'm super excited about it.
Me too. That's great. I appreciate that so much. That's awesome.
So when we show an older movie like that, does any of that trickle back down to you, or like the money? Like there, it's, I'm just like, do you still get royalties from that movie or anything like that?
I do. Believe it or not, I still get residual checks. They come quarterly. They're all over the map in terms of, like, it's not like a set thing where, like, you get a big one and then less and then less and less and less, and then finally you're getting checks for, 13 cents or whatever. You never know what you're going to get. You get the magic envelope and you open it up and it could be, oh, $300, or it could be like, oh, $4,000. Like, you have no idea what it's going to be. And it is based on a new media or like a new place where the movie is like showing. Like, sometimes I'll get excited while somebody will say, hey, I saw your movie on, it was playing on TBS. And I'm like, oh, good. That's a new spot. Okay. And there might be some residuals coming then. It was playing on E Channel. They played the hell out of it. Okay, great. That might, lead to some residuals. I don't know about your individual theater, maybe. But the checks still come in almost 20 years later. It's kind of hilarious. And now I get it and I'm like, anything over 1,000, I'll be thrilled. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it's less. You can never tell. I mean, in the beginning, there was definitely some big, big ones that were great. And then they tapered off, and then they picked up, and then they came, it goes up and down. You never know what you're going to get.
I imagine around Christmas time, it would pick up because people would be showing it, and certain channels would be showing it. So Christmas time would probably be a bigger time for you.
Right. So I would get that check in like March.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like I'm going to get one. If something's coming in December, I have no idea if it'll be big or small. I did know it was playing on, if somebody says, oh, it was playing on the plane, somebody took a picture of the back of their plane seat or whatever. Hey, your movie's in the plane. I'm like, great. Anytime it's in a new place, is a good thing. It takes a little while for the money to come. So it's like, I guess maybe if it plays during the Christmas time, you might get those residuals either in March or June or something like that.
So I guess I'm one quick question here. So I don't know exactly if it's available on streaming, but with your other, the shows that you've made, that are on streaming services now, is there a different, like, say, because it's a different environment compared to it being, put on television or available on DVD. So is there a change in, say, how movies and, the royalties are distributed if it's on a streaming service or a TV show, because I know you've done those, compared to them just being put on television or put into theaters or as such?
Right. Well, I don't know. It's funny. I haven't had a movie that was paid for directly by a streamer, but I would imagine it would be similar to the TV show. Like we did Brainchild for Netflix, and Netflix paid for it, and we don't see any money beyond the initial payment. So it's like they buy it, you get a producer fee, we ran the show, so we run the lines, so it's like we could, charge for certain things like offices and blah, 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 and you make money, some money from that. But for the most part, yeah, you get your producer fee and whatever, and that's it. That's it. And that's why, some of the, it's like, yay, there's lots of places, streamers, they're buying stuff, but it's like, yeah, it's not the same system. You get paid up front and that's all you get. And, for a long time, the streamers were very private about like the numbers. They didn't want to share how well something was doing. Just recently, Netflix started revealing their numbers. And what was crazy was, the joke I made is like our Brainchild show, which was a kid's, mostly for kids and families, and taught you about how your brain works and how the world, the universe works. We did episodes on like the ocean and outer space and human body and emotions and stuff like that. And it was a great show. We put a lot into it. And we thought we were going to get to do multiple seasons. And the joke I make is that the show is so good that they canceled it. And people's reaction is usually like, wait, I don't understand. Like, if it was good, why would they cancel it? Because they didn't have to make more. Because every year, It just plays on the streaming service, and a new crop of 7 and 8 and 9 year olds discover the show. So the show is still in the top like 15% of all Netflix programming. The same show that we made in 2018 is still today paying plenty of dividends for them and occupying entertaining and educating children. And they don't have to make more because it's just, it lives in perpetuity on their thing. And it's still timely. So yeah, the money they spent in 2018 is still paying dividends for them today, with people watching it, and they don't have to make more and spend more money. So it's like, awesome. But also that sucks for us. So now we're,
you're too good at your job.
Yeah. So it's like we had people asking all the time, like, is there going to be more Brainchild? And so what we did was we channeled our creative and educational energy into a podcast called Who Smarted? So if you have any listeners that have kids anywhere from 5 to 10, Who Smarted is a 15-minute podcast 3 times a week, science and history topics, everything that kids would love to learn about. Their favorite food, animals, space, ocean, human body, inventions, famous people. We cover it all, and we're all over the place, and it's great. And, you know, as a podcast, we own it. We own all the rights to it. I don't have a studio. I don't have a network. Nobody's giving me notes. I have writers. They write the script. I do a rewrite, and that goes to the actors. They record it as written, and it gets edited, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's making money, and, you know, it's one of the top kids' educational shows in the entire world, and we've been doing it for 4 years now. It started during the pandemic. We thought it would be, you know, last maybe during the pandemic, and it's become so huge that we can't stop doing it. So that's another thing on our plate. But, yeah, but podcasting, you know, you own your thing. So the money goes to you, and you don't have to take notes from anybody.
Wait, what? We're supposed to be getting paid for this podcast thing?
You can do this for a living? That'd be great.
Well, it's promoting the old Falcon Theater.
No, too late. I already quit my job.
I don't know what it's like driving with your kids nowadays with their devices and everything, but. Fuck, I would have loved to have had a podcast like that to play for my sons when we were driving in the car back when they were little. Because, man, I would have been interested in it. It would have kept them busy. Nowadays, things are a little different.
Hey, listen, I kept myself plenty entertained in the back by bugging Eric the entire way.
Do you want me to pull this car over?
I'll tell you, we get a lot of people. Yeah, a lot of people say, like, thank God for your show. It is the one thing that everybody can agree on to put on. And everybody, yeah, we design it. I definitely write it so that families, adults, they're not cringing and like telling the kids to put on headphones. Like it's meant to be a shared family experience. My wife says the same thing. She's like, oh, I wish this show existed when our kid was little. But,
And 15 minutes is perfect. Yeah. You know, it's like Sesame Street, right? Like those little, that keeps their attention, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's meant to be a perfect thing for the car ride to school, the car ride home from school. You could use it at break time, meal time, bath time, bedtime. Yeah, so we designed this thing with all that in mind, and it exploded. So we're really, really happy with that. I have to kind of get going. I realize, yeah, I'm recording. We're recording Slaycation today. I got to get to the studio by 1.
Okay. Well, we won't keep you any longer. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. So this was so much fun.
You meeting with Leonardo was very similar to us meeting with you.
You are our Leonardo.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how to respond to that. It's a sliding scale, right? It's a sliding scale of a hierarchy of fame. But look, it was absolute pleasure meeting you guys. I wish you the best of luck with the theater. Also, if your son, the writer, wants to reach out, I am happy. I am definitely in the mentoring phase of my career as well. As I continue to try to write stuff for myself, I'm also looking behind me at young, hungry, talented people. So I would love to, if he has anything, I would do the offer that was given to me. It's like, if he wants to send me his best one or two things, I would be happy to take a look. And, I don't know how much he's written and stuff. You said he's 25. So in my mind, he should have a couple of things written, you know? And if he hasn't, then he needs to get on the horse.
You can be his Yoda.
Happy to.
All right. Take care, Adam. Thank you.
You got it. Thanks, guys. Be well.
Have a great day.
Okay. So Adam's left us. So let's finish off our episode with the question. And this is a Christmas question that I came up with for us. Now, normally people ask, what's your favorite Christmas movie? But I turned it around a little bit. And my question is, what is your favorite movie about Christmas? So Noah, what do you think?
I mean, it's probably the one that I go back to the most, like when it, you know, it comes around this time of year. I always want to watch it at least once. And I mean, I usually, if it's on TV, I'll watch it more than once, you know, but Elf still to this day, I think is, you know, it captures that, like, one, yes, it's a Christmas movie, you know, he's Santa's elf, but he's a human, but it is about that finding the spirit, because, you know, like, it kind of had a little bit of a twist on that, you know, well, you know, Christmas spirit is gone, and, you know, he, you know, through his, you know, sheer will and love of Christmas, you know, helps bring that back to New York City, you know, so that would be what I would pick, you know, infinitely quotable. I mean, to this day, I think we still, like, I could put that movie on and still laugh as loud as I did for, you know, the 100 other times I've seen it in the past. So I'd say that would be my pick for a movie about Christmas and, you know, Christmas spirit and everything.
I love Elf. Yeah. Your mother bought For an Ugly Christmas sweater. It's got the narwhal on it. Says, "Hey, buddy, I hope you find your dad." It's a pretty sweet sweater. I also love that movie.
I heard too, like, there's, like, because I've seen people be like, oh, like, we should, I wish they made a sequel to Elf, you know. And it was like, the one good thing is Jon Favreau and Will Ferrell have both been like, from, like, what I've heard, at least, I've been like, no, I don't want to do another one. I want to leave it, which is good. I'm happy with that. Like, I'm curious if, like, studios get a hand on it, if they would, you know, make Elf with someone else, like Elf 2. But I'm happy that it was a one-off thing that leaves it as something remembered fondly.
I agree. I hope they don't make a sequel. There's lots of movies that we've talked about that before, I think. But I think my favorite part of Elf is the Peter Dinklage scene, though.
Oh, gosh, yeah. That's still such a funny scene. I remember reading that when he first gets to New York City and he's just running around the city, that all of that was just like, those are real New Yorkers. Like, when he goes up to the guy and he's like, Santa, that was just like, they just had Will Ferrell dressed as an elf. And they're like, hey, that guy looks like Santa. Go say, hey, Santa. And they just had him running around New York City acting like a goofball.
Oh, that's hilarious. So for me, being a Gen X, first of all, let me just say that Die Hard is a Christmas movie. But it is not a movie about Christmas. And I love it. I watch Die Hard every Christmas season. But it is not a movie about Christmas. For me, my favorite movie about Christmas is a little animated Netflix show called Klaus, and it's the origin story of Santa Claus.
Oh, yeah.
And I absolutely love that movie. It was your brother who recommended it.
Is it canon? Is it canon that that's what happened to Santa?
Absolutely, for sure. That is, yeah. No, for
no.
Sure.
I remember watching it. And I remember for the first bit, like, not really kind of getting, like, I'm like, I remember Eric, yeah, suggesting it. And I'm like, I don't get how this is really a Christmas movie. And then it, as the story unfolds, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, it was such a heartwarming story by the end. Like, it's one I should go back and rewatch. I don't think I've seen it since it came out.
Yeah. I've watched it a couple times. I love it. I'll watch it here this Christmas season again. And it's just absolutely beautiful hand-drawn animation too, which you don't get now.
No, I mean, I'm a sucker for anything like that.
So, let's finish off here. This is an extra long, podcast, this one, but I think it was well worth it.
I think it's one of our best.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't even talk that much. That's probably why it was so good.
We should do that for all the ones.
Just bring somebody on, let them talk. So Merry Christmas to everyone. Come out and watch Just Friends on Tuesday, December 17th. And, you know, give well wishes and best Christmas wishes and a happy new year. We may fit one more in before the new year, I guess.
We'll see how time goes.
All right. And until then, I guess we will see you at the movies.